The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And people taking part are Phyllis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. And here's round one, which is testing their knowledge of words. 2 marks if they give me the meaning approximately rightly. We begin with Phyllis Powell. Phyllis, what is henna?
Henna is what you do to your hair.
Could you...
Isn't it?
I think so. I want to be quite sure before I give you your 2 marks.
Henna.
What
henna
happens if you do?
Well, it's a kind of... I don't do it. It's the kind of thing that makes your hair red.
Yes, and what is it in itself?
It's an herb.
All right, 2 marks, 2 marks. It's Egyptian privet, and the shoots and leaves are used to make this dye, which has been used for, thousands of years, I think. As Dilly says, it makes your hair red or shades less than red, too, if necessary.
Paul, then.
I give up. Dennis Norton, what is a chiliad? C-H-I-L-I-A-D. Chiliad.
Chiliad. It's something to do with astronomy, I believe.
Could be.
Or it's an ad for... What would be an ad for
steady.
Chili? Yes.
Steady.
if it was... It could be a production of the Iliad on ice.
Well, Dennis, you've got into the right country.
I've got what?
You got into the right country.
Greece.
It's Greece. It's a Greek word, Jack.
Yes.
Chiliad. It was a successor to the... it's a kind of brutal version of the Iliad. No? I'm sure it's to do with astronomy.
I'll give you half a mark. It is the Greek for 1,000 or 1,000 years, and it could be 1,000 light years, I suppose, hence astronomy might conceivably come in.
What might?
Nancy Spain, what is the huckle? H-U-C-K-L-E, the huckle.
The huckle?
It's a version of the twist. It's on
well,
the record.
Getting quite near.
You mean you put your thigh bone out?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you 1 mark, which is fairly generous, because it is, in fact, the hip or the haunch.
Oh, it's...
So you're near enough. Mm-hmm. And the huckle bone is the hip bone, and therefore it comes in tremendously with a twist, I've no doubt.
What's it connected to?
It's connected to the feet at one end and the torso at the other. Thank you. What is a penstock?
They're permitted to resign. Penstock?
Yes. Oh. You really do know this.
I do know it.
Yes.
Well, of course I know it.
Well,
I know how it's used. I know how it could be used in a sentence. Why is a bookkeeper like a clockmaker? Because he can make a pencil tick. But a pen doesn't tick. No, pen stock. It's a form of audible writing.
You think about those boats of yours, Frank, and you'll get it.
Oh, it's nautical.
Yes.
Yes. Well, there we are. 1 mark.
no marks at all. It's a sluice. Or a floodgate.
What a detective. Floodgate?
It's the thing that fastens up the end of a mill dam, for instance. Or the trough of the water wheel. Mm. Sorry. Mm. Well, before we start round two, I give each team a quotation which they can write down. And I want the 2 women members of the team then to study the quotations, and at the end of the program I shall ask them where they come from, the source of the quotation itself. And Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is seated one day at the organ, and Nancy Spain and Dennis, yours is the old folks at home. And then at the end of the program I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their idea of how these words really came to be said or written. Well, and so we come to the next round, which is about rhyming slang. And these are all expressions which are in slang use today, but they're the result of what's called rhyming slang. I want to know what they mean and where they come from, the derivation. 2 marks if you get it reasonably right. Dennis Powell, What's the word sky slang for?
Skyrocket.
Yes.
Pocket.
That's it. Skyrocket, rhyming slam for pocket.
I was going to tell you an absolutely lovely one, but I won't tell you until you've asked the others in case it comes in.
Oh, well, yes, yes, that's very kind of it, but we'd like it all the same at the end. And Eddie Norton, what is your whistle?
It's my suit.
Jolly good. And short for?
Well, it's short for the person who's taller than I am, but it fits me. Whistle and flute.
Whistle and flute, rhyming slang for suit and so abbreviated to whistle. Two marks rolled up. Auntie Spain, what are the apples?
Apples and pears, stairs.
Good, two marks again. And Frank, what or who is Rosie?
Rosie Lee.
Yes.
She's a well known charwoman. Therefore, Rosie Lee T.
Rosie Lee T it is, two marks. Gillis, what was yours?
Mine was, will you sausage me a gooses? Which
with
is
pleasure, dear.
Cash, you will you? Come on, then. Cash me a check, that means. Sausage and mash, cash. Yes. Goose's neck, check.
Jolly good. Well, that's going to be very good. Nice. The next round's literary. I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it next line or next two or three lines. Two marks if they fairly correctly completed, and two more if they say where it comes from. And here's yours, Dennis Powell. Can storied urn or animated bust back to its mansion call the fleeting breath?
Well, it comes from Gray's Elegy.
Right.
By Gray.
By Gray, which is an elegy, which was written in the churchyard.
Yes.
At something which I don't believe exists called Stoke Poges.
Oh, it exists,
right?
It does.
You just wait till the letters start coming.
Well, that's a good start, too. Two out of the four possible bars. Can you complete it?
Animated bars. What was the next line, please?
Back to its mansion called the fleeting breath.
Breath. Something dust.
Yes.
And something.
It is a difficult one, I think. Can storied urn or animated bust back to its mansion call the fleeting breath? Can honor's voice provoke the silent dust or flattery soothe the dull, cold ear of death? Thomas Gray, elegy written in a country churchyard, two out of four. Dennis Norton, when to the sessions of sweet, silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past.
This is Shakespeare's sonnet, an Easter bonnet or Mickey Mouse.
Yes. Yes.
It's Shakespeare's sonnet. Now, wait a minute. Remember the things from. I don't know how it goes on. I know it ends about this friend of his, when he thinks of this friend of his, all these things that die
yes.
don't matter so much.
Yes.
He puts it a bit more poetically than that.
There's a bit.
Each man to his trade, you know. But I don't know how the next two lines go.
Two, I think, out of four. When the sessions of sweet silent thought I summon up remembrance of things past. I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes, new wail, my dear time's waste. Shakespeare, sonnet number 30. Nancy Spain, souls of poets dead and gone, what Elysium have ye known, happy field or mossy cavern?
Oh, something, something, the Mermaid Tavern.
Yes.
It's Keats.
Yes.
It's the bit about the Mermaid Tavern. Pledging with many a smack the mermaids in the almanac.
Zodiac. But near enough.
Old Keats's Merminac. Yeah.
I think you'll get three out of four, although we haven't got the next line.
So
the
contented smack.
Yes, well, pledging with contented smack the mermaid in the Zodiac.
But still, what are your lines?
Those come a bit later.
Yeah, but tell me your lines again.
I will. Sails of poets dead and gone. What Elysium have ye known, happy field or mossy cavern, choicer than the Mermaid Tavern? Have ye tippled drink more fine than mine host's canary wine? John Keats, lines on the Mermaid Tavern. Three out of four. Frank Muir, I took the oars, the pilot's boy who now doth crazy go.
I took the oars, and now the boy doth crazy go. Is this did shout out across the boat, row, row, quick, quick, row. This is the Ancient Mariner.
It's the Ancient Mariner. All right, two for knowing it's the Ancient Mariner. You're not going to get the next lines, are you?
I'm not, personally, no. Maybe the audience will.
Sooner or later, he fell down the fit, that pilot boy, didn't he?
I think it's another stanza.
Now, you're getting very close indeed. I can almost give you half a mark for that. No, not quite. The line just before is the pilot shrieked and fell down in a fit, so the pilot was out of action. He couldn't do any rowing or even any steering or conning the ship or anything at all.
But
the pilot boy then unfortunately went crazy as well, leaving only the narrator to row. I took the oars, the pilot's boy, who now doth crazy go, laughed loud and long, and all the while his eyes went to and fro. Ha ha, quoth he, full plain I see, the devil knows how to row. Coleridge, rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
It must have been a happy ship.
luckily, the pin stops were firmly closed.
And that ship went down at that point, not the ship, the little boat they were in, but the main ship went down at exactly that point. Oh, I take a deep breath. Well, next round is the origins and derivations of phrases. 2 marks if you give me the present day meaning of these expressions and tell me their origin as well. Dearest Powell, yours is upon my Davy, or I take my Davy.
Ah. Davy means an affidavit, doesn't it?
Yes, and therefore its colloquial meaning is...
Take my oath, yes.
Yes, it's a written statement used as judicial proof. Oh. 2 marks, clear. Dennis Norton, dibs or plenty of dibs?
Dibs is or are money.
Yes.
I don't know where it came... Actually... We were once sent a script from America. It's a film script that was written originally as an American story with American dialogue, and they decided to make it in England. So they replaced the American dialogue with English dialogue, but whoever had replaced it was a writer who'd never been to England, and he'd done it by consulting an English dictionary of slang. And unfortunately, the dictionary must have been about 80 years old, because you had things like bus conductors going down the bus saying, would you tender your dibs? And the policemen were all called peelers.
Well, 1 mark so far, Dennis, but it does mean money.
Didn't mean any money to us, we couldn't. But I don't know how it...
doubt that it would anyway, because it originally dibsterns, it's short for dibsterns, which is a game like fives for children. You played it with knuckle bones, sheep's knuckle bones. And they were known as dibs.
Huckleburns.
Right. And therefore, any kind of gaming counter became called dibs, and thence, bit by bit, became a name for money as well. Rather a far-fetched explanation, I can't help thinking.
I think mine's much.
One out of two. Nancy said, Darby's, D-A-R-B-I-E-S.
Darby's was Darby Kelly, or a hat, or it could be a hundred of things.
No, no.
Or cufflinks.
I did a bit of mime, yes. And it didn't work.
Handcuffs or manacles.
Yes, 1 out of 2 so far for handcuffs. And why are they called dogs?
Well, I don't know.
Well, it's back in the time when Dennis got his American script. The policemen originally were nicknamed John Darby's. And that was possibly an anglicised version of gendarme, and therefore the handcuffs were known as John Darby's bands, or Father Darby's hands, and therefore Darby. Very difficult indeed. 1 out of 2.
A palpable lie.
Yeah.
Thank God. Basic English.
Oh, I don't know. The basic English swear.
That's what it is ironic, this, David. It isn't what it really was.
David, isn't it one of these nutty, slightly nutty things of reducing the language down to about 2,000 words?
It's that sort of thing, yes, of that order.
Well, that's enough, isn't it? 1 and a half. I'll settle for 1 and a third.
Basically. Yes, I think 1 and a half is not bad.
I think we should have these marks in decimals.
We have to do that. Well, nowadays, as Frank says, it's an ironic expression, meaning rather primitive short words, usually used forcibly. But basic English was a selection of 850 English words invented or put together by C.K. Ogden as a sort of common first step towards learning the English language, and had quite a lot of currency at one time. It has an odd reason for being called basic. The words is it's short for the words British American Scientific International Commercial. It's still going.
Flatly don't believe it. It's basic.
That isn't Tanya Wongton. It really is true. And now we come to the last round and go back to the quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the programme and start with two marks, still his power. I'd like the origin of your quotation, seated one day at the organ.
Is that the one about his fingers and straying idly over the keys?
Yes.
The Lost Chord.
The Lost Chord it is. Do you remember who wrote it?
Arthur Sullivan.
No, Arthur Sullivan wrote the music.
He's an American lady with three names.
That's right, Adelaide and Potter. Died in 1885. All right, Nancy Spear. And the origin of your quotation, The Old Folks at Home.
It's a very well-known ballad, Jack, by Stephen Foster.
Quite right. Two more. And now I'm going to ask Frank and Dennis to tell me their explanations of how the quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the larger amount of applause from you, the audience here in the studio. And first to Frank. Your quotation, you remember, Frank, was seated one day at the organ.
This story is really a tribute to the man who compiles this program, Mr. Edward J. Mason. You see, because he's such a good marksman with a rifle. I have difficulty getting up in the... Well, I have no difficulty getting up. But I have difficulty getting up in a civilized manner. And my wife read somewhere that this is due to a shortage of energy. This sounded plausible to me. And it could be cured by taking those little tablets of glucose, which give you energy. So she gave me a packet of these things, and that's really why, Ted... No, I haven't filled it in yet, have I? Well, you see, this morning I got up, and my wife had given me the tablets, and I'd slipped them in my jacket pocket, and I woke up and shaved, and I was driving into work, and I got through Staines, and I remember looking in the driving mirror, and I realised I'd only shaved the right-hand side of my face. I'd entirely forgotten to shave the left-hand side. Then I realised, as I was driving, that I had a torn knee to my suit. The knee was torn out. So I was going to a My Word recording that evening with the left or down audience side unshaven with a large hole in my knee. This was terribly worrying. And then I had a thought, actually, in the middle of the afternoon, that I'd left a suit at the same day cleaners the previous August. If I could only just collect that suit, I could change and before going on to the show and be sort of fairly respectable. So I called in at the shop and I collected the suit. And I was walking along Bond Street and I suddenly realised I had nowhere to change. So I thought the best thing to do, probably, in Bond Street was to faint. And then an ambulance would come along, and I could probably get the attendant, if it was a lady, to turn her head, and I could change in the ambulance. So I sort of swooned gently away, clutching my good suit in Bond Street. And I got walked on by a rather large and muddy boxer dog, who then turned and expressed additional interest, so I got up. So when I got to My Word, and I had a rotten supper because I had no time, and I dashed into a self-help, and I got caught up in the whole line of people hurrying past all those things, and I ended up with three lemon curd tarts, which made me go, pardon, and a small white saucer of mustard pickles. But so I was in no great shape, and I thought the only thing to rally myself would be if I could get some sort of sudden thing of energy, and I suddenly realised this packet of glucose my wife had given me. So I surreptitiously took one hand off my knee, got a tablet, popped it in my mouth, and the show started. Well, the first round went round, and we came to the poetry round, and I suddenly realised this tablet in my mouth wasn't melting the way a glucose tablet should. It was really being very peculiar indeed. So I chewed on it, and my jaw became fast lodged. I realised what had happened. My children were always substituting things. And what had happened was that I realised the children had taken the glucose tablets out and substituted little bars of bubble gum. And I was chewing bubble gum, and it was very nearly my turn. And this is terrible stuff, you know. I was chewing away, and I was breathing out, and suddenly a bubble started forming. There's nothing I could do, because one hand was covering me, and the other hand. And the more I breathed, the more this awful pink sort of thing, the sphere, was developing in front of my face. And it was growing larger and larger, and the program might well have ceased. I mean, it would have been lost to the civilized world. And luckily, Edward J. Mason, Ted, actually had a gun with him. You see, that stick he carries isn't a stick. It's actually a very powerful air rifle, because he has a morbid fear of eagles. And, and Ted, who's looking for that, realized the predicament I was in. And he opened the doors at the back of the studio, and he took careful aim with his air gun. And he shot, and there was a faint hiss, and the bubble collapsed. And my word was saved for the world. And that is really the story, and it's a tremendous tribute to Ted's marksmanship, because it's a good, 30 yards with an air gun, and an air gun isn't a very powerful thing, and I think it's a great tribute to his marksmanship. And that's really my story. I mean, you can talk if you will, about Robin Hood and his bow and arrow, but I say, if you want to see marksmanship, see Ted one day at the air gun.
Down so many by roads simultaneously in my life. We'll pass on to Dennis Norden, and Dennis, yours, I remember, was the old folks at home.
Yes, we do get some extraordinary things happen on this programme. They used to introduce this programme as being done by people whose business is words. Because of that, any kind of literary problem, you find that people tend to come to us as kind of literary doctors in a way. One of the weirdest was one day, we were seated one day at the office, and the door burst open, and a woman was announced whose name was Mrs. Amelia Battersby. She came, and she's rather elderly, and she had 4 wedding rings on, and she had piercing eyes, and we said, Mrs. Battersby, what is your problem? And she said, I am that most pitiful of creatures, person from Porlock. Now, that name, Porlock, it didn't exactly ring a bell. It was a sort of faint tinkle in my mind, if you know what I mean. And I was thinking, Porlock, there's some vaguely unpleasant association. Or is that wedlock? And suddenly, the phrase, a person from Porlock, came back to me, and I said, Coleridge. And she said, exactly. And she reminded me of this story, which is a classic of literary legend, that Coleridge's poem, Kublai Khan, came to him in a dream. He dreamt the whole of the poem complete. And when he woke up, he ran to his desk and he wrote it down. And he was still in full song, as it were, when suddenly there was a knock on the door, and in walked a visitor whom we've never known the identity of, but Coleridge said it was a person from Porlock. And this person from Porlock stayed with him, and by the time he or she left, the poem had gone completely out of Coleridge's head, and that's all we've ever had of it, so it's an unfinished poem. I said, well, what can we do about it? I mean, what is your beef, madam? Because we try to be as polite as possible. And she said, well, I want your help. She said, I want to erect a monument to Coleridge at Porlock. I said, well, what kind of monument? She said, well, in that poem, which starts, in Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, I would like to build a stately pleasure dome at Porlock in Somerset. Well, I thought this was quite a good idea. So we're going to build one, you know, stately pleasure domes. It's quite a pleasant place to have. And I said, well, what help can we be? He said, well, will you be the literary advisors on it? So he said, all right. I said, now, I want it built exactly to the specifications laid down in the poem. He said, I shall leave you all the money, and I'll go away, and you tell me when it's done. Fair enough. And we had a wonderful 18 months, because it was lovely in the summer, poor lot there, and there was no, she had these four husbands, all of whom had left her plenty of dibs, and there was no expense spared, time and a half on Sundays. There were some snags, you know, you had to build it exactly to the specifications. Remember, it goes in Xanadu did Kubla Khan's stately pleasure dome decree, where Alf the sacred river ran through caverns measureless to man down to the sunless sea. Well, the river was a bit of a problem, you see. You've heard of a town like Alice. Well, we had to find a river like Alf. we got through that one, and it took 18 months, but we finished it, as stately a pleasure dome as you would wish to find. And we rang her up, and we said, "Madam, your pleasure dome is done." And she said, "Oh, that. Oh, heavens, I'd forgotten about that." And what had transpired was she had married a fifth husband. And he was a chap about half her age, a modern poet, and consequently she wasn't interested in any literary figure any earlier than Colin Wilson now. So we were left with this pleasure dome on our hands. And the whole object of this story is to tell you about this, if you know anybody who would be interested in a freehold pleasure dome. But there it is, freehold, if you want it. Or as Stephen Foster said... freehold folks a dough.
Well, I think you like that. A very different story, as much as the other one. I'm going to share the marks, give them one each. And that brings us to a final score in which Nancy Spain and Dennis Norden win by 2 marks. From Dennis Powell and Frank Muir, and it also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dennis Powell, Nancy Spain, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longman. The program was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶